Saudi grasp the opportunity and work towards an immediate ceasefire, plus the fact that it's becoming a growing threat to the international community and to the peace in the world. And also it has made a big reflection on the inefficiency of the United Nations and its various institutions.
Of course, and Dr. Husseini, we're going to touch on that UN position in a moment. But, Jonathan, I just wanted to touch on this idea of the bloodlust, some have said, about coming out of the Israeli war cabinet, about, you know, perhaps we haven't killed enough, we haven't flattened enough. And I know that Fahima has some material there that really emphasizes some of that. But what do you make of Benjamin Netanyahu's own domestic situation vis-a-vis this confrontation?
He's becoming more unpopular, isn't he, in Israel? I think that's clear, although nothing really is clear in Israel. I think that Israel itself is the most truth-starved people in the world. I don't think they're watching or able to watch or witness what's happening on their borders. And I think that that is, if they did, I think Benjamin Netanyahu would be even more unpopular than he is. I think that what's happening is a deterioration of the basic structure of the Israeli state. And I think that's composed of a number of different elements. One is the divisions that were already there before the conflict started between the people that wanted to kind of maintain some kind of democratic and constitutional order, and the other, the right wing of the Israeli political spectrum, who wanted to see an escalated genocide and an annexation of the occupied territories. But that has got even worse, and those two sides have become attached to different elements in the situation, so that the hostages and their families and the communities that surround them seem to be connected to that constitutionalist position within the Israeli state. Whereas I think that the genocidal kind of movement, which has been where the proponents are the right wing, has also extended itself and got more and more intense.
Well, if not now, when would be their arguments if you had genocide in mind, this is a perfect time. Yeah. All right, come back to you there. Dr. Husseini, this idea here that the U.S., as Jonathan Chadwick mentioned, are feeling under pressure here, and they're not going into flight mode, they're coming out in fight mode. How are you seeing any potential vote here in the Security Council?
Well, I think the Americans need a position to rescue the embarrassment they have put themselves in cahoot with the Israeli military activities. As my friend Jonathan was saying, they need to do a U-turn and in a pragmatic way. A week ago, there was this vote in the Security Council, and Britain abstained. It would have been more sensible for the USA administration also to abstain and allow the international community to have the hand to go through a legitimate call for immediate ceasefire and revision of whatever has been done in a drastic inhumanitarian approach to the situation, and probably think of an alternative approach with the help of the international community to get America and Israel out of this quagmire, at the same time trying to help the Gazan people to continue surviving in that small piece of land which they have been isolated and living in as an open prison for the last 12-plus years.
There have been statements from Human Rights Watch, from Amnesty and so on, about the Israelis using the deprivation of food, water, medicines and so on as a weapon. Surely that can't be great for PR.
It's not great for PR, of course it isn't, but the Israelis have openly avowed a policy which they first, I think, put into practice in an ostentatious way in the Dahiya suburb of Beirut, when they thought that they would attack that part of Beirut because they felt that that was where Hezbollah were kind of stationing themselves. And they decided that they would practice a policy of not making any distinction between civilians and combatants. And that policy, which is Eisenkot, was the Israeli general in charge of that operation, that policy is now a load on the Israelis, because having thought that that was a good idea, they now are in the situation where they can't move through human blood. They're up to their ears in it, and they can't move, and they don't know which way to turn. And I think we're witnessing a complete failure of that policy in terms of what the Israelis are doing. The Americans have said, Lloyd Austin himself has said, look, you may find a strategic defeat happening because of the failure of this possible of that policy. This is the man that led the American part in the retaking of Mosul from ISIL in Iraq. I mean, he was saying this might be a strategic problem for you. And it's also, the other thing that he let slip the other day is, we don't want Hamas to win. And you suddenly are faced with the prospect of what that winning might involve. I think it was a slip of the tongue.
And also, isn't that just the code word for the resistance? Like, how do you crush the resistance from a people who've already lost so much? I want you to mull on that while we go here, because the special coordinator for the Middle East peace process, Tor Wennesland, said the bombardment of Gaza had made this the deadliest year in the history of the conflict. Addressing the UN, the special coordinator said he's also deeply concerned by escalating tensions in the occupied West Bank, including in East Jerusalem, Al-Quds. Let's hear some more of what he had to say.
The magnitude of hostilities between Israel and Hamas and the scope of death and destruction in Gaza have been unprecedented and unbearable to witness. I unequivocally condemn the killing of civilians in Gaza, including women and children. I mourn the loss of every civilian, including 131 UN colleagues, the single largest loss of life in the history of the organization. I'm also deeply concerned by escalating tensions in the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem. Intensified armed exchanges between Palestinians and Israeli security forces, predominantly in the context of Israeli operations, have led to exceedingly high levels of fatalities and arrests. I reiterate that security forces must exercise maximum restraints and use lethal force only when it's strictly unavoidable to protect life. I am appalled by the numerous instances of officials glorifying violence, encouraging the killing of civilians. Such rhetoric is abhorrent and must be clearly rejected by leaders on all sides. Leaders have an obligation to clearly and explicitly condemn acts of terror and violence directed against civilians.
You're still with me. This is Gaza Under Attack. And my guests, Jonathan Chadwick and Dr. Ali Husseini, have remained put, thank goodness. We just saw a little bit there, Jonathan, about advocacy in places that perhaps didn't feel they had that kind of agency. Your reaction, first of all, to the boycott movement, but also this idea that Malaysia is saying, listen, your ships and your cargo can't dock here. We won't intervene in other ways, but right now we're hitting you in the pockets.
Yeah, no, it's a very, very, very significant movement. And actually, I only learned about this earlier today, and I'm grateful to the program for putting it in front of me. And I think that it's unsurprising that these countries and these societies, they know what colonialism is, they know what imperialism is, and that certainly is shared between the Malaysians and the Yemenis. I mean, you have to consider that during the 50s and 60s, both these places were fighting against British imperialism. They were fighting the last remnants of British imperialism. And they share that history, and they presumably share an identification with the people struggling for its liberation in the Palestinian people. And it's not, I think, on the one hand, it's a good movement to see happening. You think that commercial imperatives are going to rule the world forever. But what actually is beginning to appear is moral principled stands by governments and certainly by peoples throughout the world in favour of the oppressed of Palestine. And I think that that's to be welcomed. And I think that part of it must be accredited to the control and dignity that the axis of resistance have deployed in the struggle, to the Ansarullah in Yemen being so firm in its rejection of any kind of scare tactics by the Americans or the other powers that surround them. They themselves know about the kind of bombardment that the Palestinians
Indeed.
Are undergoing, because they had it at the hands of the Saudis, and the Saudis were using the same weapons that the Israelis are using, backed by the same Western powers.
So they understand all too well.
They understand all too well.
Indeed, and I just want to bring you back in, Dr. Husseini, because this is all made possible because there has been a public awakening. How are you seeing it?
I think what Western politicians are missing out here is that the fact that this process of young people awakening throughout the world, mainly in the Western capitals, is going to backfire greatly on how they can conclude this episode in Gaza and in the region. Not only that, as you said, like people like Yemen, which have been under war, sanctions, and deprivation and famine for 7 years, suddenly wake up and say any shipment of weapons or goods or oil to the Israeli aggression is going to be stopped to go through the Red Sea, despite the limited resources. So these people have woken up to feel that this colonial control of the world politics can be challenged. And this itself is a demonstration of the weakness of the Western superpowers, if you like, as a whole. And that subsequently will push these countries who have got all the natural minerals and the gas the world needs in the future, in the near future, is going to be shifted or forced towards China, Russia, and other third world countries who are emerging as local superpowers in their own right. And obviously that will gradually make the imperialist or colonialist supremacy and hegemony much weaker, and probably sign the early failure of these policies if the current leaders continue to believe they can continue dominating the world politics and dictating the international law and order, which is beginning to be seen as think of the past, as what's happening in Malaysia, in Asia, in Yemen, and around in the Middle East is demonstrating.
Dr. Al Husseini, I just want you to put your medical hat on for a second. Some of what we just saw in terms of what this means for patients and healthcare workers under these conditions, may I have a quick comment on that from you, sir?
Yeah, it's unfortunate. Nobody could have imagined in this day and age there would be doctors operating in the way they were operating without any light or any sanitation, as Fahima was saying, and if the life these injured people for any reason under great danger, and to allow them to die in front of their doctors and nurses who are trying their best, including risking their lives to save them. And it's really something that goes against all the Geneva Conventions in war situations. And obviously it's a shame on the humanity to remain silent, to allow such situations to happen or even to prevail, unfortunately.
Indeed. sometimes words fail us when we're trying, Jonathan Chadwick, to just really paint a picture for the audience there as if some of these images were not enough. But I'd like to bring in a slightly different aspect to this. Your background is in the arts. And we were remiss not to talk about some of the amazing collaborations you've had with Palestinian artists and theatre groups inside Gaza, and how perhaps we might not just be mourning the loss of some of those artists, but in fact the loss of the industry in general.
We're still in touch with our partners in Gaza. I heard from them this morning, which is good. They're alive, and I wouldn't know whether they're well, but they're certainly alive. Since the escalation of the genocide in Gaza, we've received messages from Hossam Madun. We've received maybe 30 messages that are accounts of what he's going through and what he's been through in the evacuation from the north, his experiences in Nusayrat refugee camp, his contact with his friends, his helping at the local medical facilities, his wife's work for an NGO there, his relationship with his families, his very, very sick mother and his coping with that, his reactions to the other events that are happening around him. And we've been able to put on three readings of these accounts at a small art gallery in North London, and we've now created a film of those readings, which we're going to make as an installation in that gallery. But we've collected around ourselves a group of extremely talented and wonderful artists, and they put on an event the night before last at the Arcola Theatre in Hackney, where they brought together a lot of people from accounts from Jenin, from different sections of the Palestinian population, doing readings and then engaging in a kind of discussion.
To keep it live, to keep
it live, keep in contact. Look at the quality of the writing that Hossam has managed to achieve, the descriptions that he's managed to make, and ask people to listen to them being read by other people and to just kind of ponder and try to take in what's happening. So we're going to, of course, that's mainly the work that I'm doing.
So resistance in a different form, Jonathan. We just have time for maybe one last thought here about the end game in this. We spoke last, the toll has doubled. We're thinking ceasefire, but perhaps not right now. Your final thoughts?
What do I think is going to happen?
In 30 seconds.
It's very,
seconds.
Very dangerous
it
for
is,
in 30
it?
Seconds to even... Well, I think that what we'll see is we'll see eventually the end of the Zionist entity in that part of the world. And the big question is, can there be an Israel without Zionism? Can we envisage the people there living in peace with each other? The end game, the end vision must be of peace, democracy and justice. And I think that's what's in everybody's hearts. And it's just the embargo on tenderness and the embargo on human feelings that the Israeli population undergo and carry out that we've seen evidence of earlier in the programme.
Indeed, those beautiful thoughts, Jonathan, is where we'll have to leave it and wrap for this show. My many thanks to the guests for their contributions. Gaza Under Attack will be back with more. Until then, continue to keep Palestine in your hearts.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
Allah.
for humanity.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. This is Hussein Latifi, and you're listening to your program for humanity from IRIB English Radio. In this program, we talk about the concept of humankind in the Holy Quran. And in the previous episode, we started the discussion about the different dimensions of human being according to the verses of the Holy Quran. There are different dimensions that have been counted in the Holy Quran for human being, like the body and then the soul. And then we have different aspects, like when we talk about the soul, there are different layers of the soul, an-nafsul mutma'inna, the soul at peace, the commanding soul, the self-blaming soul, an-nafsul lawama, the heart, qalb, al-fu'ad, two different names for the heart, and then we have aql, intellect. So, and hawa, desire. So it's a long and good discussion to have about how many different aspects this being has and what different functions are out there to look for. And in the previous episode, we talked about the main discussion, the beginning and the starting point for the discussion, which is the duality of mind and body, or spirit and body. And we said, according to the Holy Quran, human body is created from, first initially created from mud, hama and masnoon, aging mud, and from teen, clay, and ma'in mahin, in another verse, ma'in, a base fluid that is somehow even disgusting and impure. And there's a reason why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala brings this about. There might be different reasons. This could function as a metaphor. For example, in another verse, we have Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is capable to bring about from among, when he talks about cattle, وَإِنَّ لَكُمْ فِي الْأَنْعَامِ الْعِبْرَةِ, he says, there's a lesson and there's a sign for you in the cattle, in the creation of cattle. And what is that sign? The sign is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala brings about مِنْ بَيْنِ فَرْثٍ وَدَمٍ لَبَنًا خَالِصًا سَائِغًا لِلشَّارِبِينَ, from among things that are filthy, like the blood that is in the body of this animal, and then the food that has actually turned into the waste and has gone through the process of digestion. So in the body of this animal, there are these things that are filthy, but Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala brings about from among these things, from the middle of these two, he brings about the milk that is enjoyable to drink, and is pure and is clean. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, for one reason, he wants to show his power, that I am capable of bringing about from one drop of a base fluid, ma and mahin, I can bring about the human being which has different surprising functions. And that is one thing, that is showing the power of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that the design, the miraculous design of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Unfortunately, some people, when they say, for example, the design of the nature, as if the nature is the designer itself, but nature is just a name for the design. And who designed this whole system? So this could be one reason why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala keeps referring to the origin of human body. Another reason is, again, interesting, but we leave it for the segment that is after the break. So we will have a short break and we will continue the discussion.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. This is Hussein Latifi, and you're listening to your program for humanity. We were talking about the different dimensions of human being. We were talking about body, of the human being. And we said that in the Holy Quran, there are different references to the origin of human body. And we said one reason could be that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants to remind us about His power, that He is powerful to do mysterious things, bringing about this surprising being out of a thing that that looks filthy, that is very low in quality. Another thing is, another reason might be a kind of lesson for us that we see also in the words of Imam Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi salam. He says in Nahj al-Balagha that ajabtu, I am in awe and I'm surprised by man. Why? Because awwaluhu nutfa, his origin, he starts his being, his journey from being a nutfa, a drop of fluid. And akharuhu jifa, and at the end he will turn into a dead, rotten body. And both of these things are things that people are disgusted by and they run away from. Even if a drop of that thing is on your clothes, you cannot pray and you should wash it. Or the dead, rotten, or decomposing body, nobody wants to be close to that. And then at the middle of the two stages, he is a bag. I mean, his body is like a bag carrying the waste. That is true, because in always as the natural process of digestion happens in our body, there is always a little bit of that waste within ourselves. Again, we don't like that either. And in all of this, starting the being from that point, ending in that point, and at the middle being having that function, human being still has the boldness to, or has the arrogance to stand against his Lord, for example, or to think of himself as a high being or something like that. So it could have that humbling function for us, for some of us actually, who have forgotten a lot of realities about themselves, and sometimes even in our relationship with others, we have this also when, for example, the dua that we say, كَمَا رَبَّيَانِي سَغِيرًا, when we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to have mercy upon our parents because they nurtured us when we were little ones. We could not do anything for ourselves and our parents took care of us. And if it wasn't for their care, we would have died in a painful, gradual process. But it was the parents who did it, meaning taking care of us and reminding us, if you want to talk to your parents, if you want to talk to your father, always remember the time that you were just a little being and you did not have any power for anything. Or in another verse, the beginning of Surah Al-Insan, that Quran reminds us of the time that shay'an madhkura, we were not anything to be referred to. So this has this humbling lesson for us, and this could be another reason why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Holy Quran makes references to that stage, that we have created man from a drop of fluid, maheen, a base fluid. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to help us be humble as much as possible and at the same time know the true value of ourselves. This would be for this episode. Thank you very much for listening. Inshallah, join me next episode to continue the discussion. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. صلى الله على محمد وعلى آل النبي. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. Thank you.
in the limelight. Russia's foreign ministry has reiterated that Moscow will not allow Ukraine to be a Nazi state and pose a threat to both Russia and other countries. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Qatar's Al Jazeera television network has covered this story and tells us more. Russia has said any further military aid by the United States to Ukraine will be a fiasco. Ahead of Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's meeting with U.S. leaders, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said Russia would very closely follow Kiev-related developments in Washington. Dmitry Peskov told a regular news briefing, "It is important for everyone to understand that the tens of billions of dollars pumped into Ukraine did not help it gain any success on the battlefield." Peskov added, "The tens of billions of dollars that Ukraine wants to be pumped with are also headed for the same fiasco." Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, who has already received more than $100 billion worth of American military aid, is currently in the U.S. capital, Washington, to plead for more aid. And he met and conferred with U.S. President Joe Biden on Tuesday, 12th of December. The Ukrainian leader also met with congressional leaders from both political parties, Democratic and Republican. Political analysts said Zelensky faces his real challenge when he addresses U.S. senators in Congress and met the new Republican Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson. On Monday, 11th of December, speaking to the audience at the National Defense University in Washington, the actor-turned-politician, Volodymyr Zelensky, claimed Russian President Vladimir Putin must lose. He said U.S.-led Western countries must not delay the continued delivery of arms and munitions to Kiev. Zelensky asked the American leaders not to betray Ukrainian forces fighting against Russia. Since Russia launched its special military operation in Donbass in February of 2022, the United States has led a Western coalition sending tens of billions of dollars worth of weaponry and munitions to Kiev. However, Republicans are ever more openly rejecting allocating more funding for the continuous arms and munitions shipments to Ukraine, seeing their support for Ukraine as their loss and a distraction from domestic problems at home. Republican lawmakers have pointed to Kiev's failure in winning the proxy war against Russia, insisting that funding the abortive Ukrainian war is a waste of U.S. taxpayers' money. The lawmakers want President Biden to redirect U.S. taxpayer money towards domestic issues, particularly stopping illegal immigration along the U.S.-Mexico border. While Russia announced on Tuesday, 12th of December, that Russian troops had advanced significantly in southern Ukraine. Earlier, Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu pointed out that Kiev forces continued to push for victory on the battlefield against the superior Russian troops. He said, "This is plunging Ukraine into an abysmal self-annihilation." Russia has on numerous occasions warned that the continued supply of Western weaponry and munitions to Kiev would only prolong the war, adding to losses and exacerbating the suffering of the Ukrainian people. The Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu added, "The United States and its allies continue to arm the Ukrainian forces, while the Kiev regime continues to throw untrained soldiers into senseless assault and slaughter." Shoigu added, "These cynical actions by the West and their henchmen in Kiev are only pushing Ukraine towards self-destruction." The Russian President Vladimir Putin also stated on repeated occasions that the military campaign in Donbass was necessary to defend the people against Western aggression and its expansionist policy. The Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has made similar remarks in the past, saying Kiev is fully aware of Russia's demands and could simply fulfill them by bringing the war to an end. Sergei Lavrov said, "Our proposals for the demilitarization and denazification of the territories controlled by Kiev and the elimination of threats to Russia's security emanating from there, including our new lands, are well known to the enemy." Sergei Lavrov added, "The point is simple, fulfill them for your own good. Otherwise, the issue will be decided by the Russian army." The American newspaper The Hill has also covered this same story. An emergency spending bill to provide billions of dollars in new assistance for wars has been blocked in the U.S. Senate as lawmakers seek to drop Ukraine from the aid package, which also includes Israel. The package would include roughly $60 billion of help for Ukraine, keeping up pressure on Russia, and more than $10 billion for the ongoing Israeli aggression against Palestinians of the Gaza Strip. The package also includes some aid for Taiwan. The emergency spending bill included $20 billion for border security. The vote was 49 in favor and 51 against, leaving the $110.5 billion measure short of the 60 votes needed in the 100-member Senate to pave the way to starting a debate. The Republicans in the Senate blocked the White House's request for new aid, despite last-minute appeals by President Joe Biden. Republicans contend that they want more accountability than they are getting from the Biden administration for U.S. taxpayer money that goes to Ukraine. If the negotiations over the legislation do not produce results in the coming days, the bill could be delayed until after the Christmas holidays. Some senators are proposing working through the Christmas holiday to reach a compromise. However, if the bill passes the Senate, it will still needs to be approved in the Republican-majority U.S. House of Representatives, where dozens of Republicans voted against further aid to Ukraine. In the Republican-led House, Speaker Mike Johnson has made it clear he will not agree to spending any more money for the war in Ukraine. President Biden has led the coalition back in Kiev, but support has been waning among Republicans in Congress, and the administration has warned that it will run out of money for more aid for Ukraine in the weeks ahead. President Biden spoke with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and the leaders of G7 nations on Wednesday, 6 December, to discuss how to shore up Western aid for Kiev. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky warned Western leaders that Moscow was counting on Western unity to collapse and said Russia has ramped up pressure on the front lines of the war. But the precarious prospects of aid package for Ukraine has been clear since a classified Ukraine briefing for senators on Tuesday, 5 December, that saw several Republican senators walk out of the session.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, you are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we are going to look at some principles of upbringing children so that the audience gets a detailed description of the matter concerning how to raise their children Islamically. And today we have in our studio guest speaker, Sister Salma Khalfan, who is an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qom. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program, Sister Salma.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much for inviting me over.
We were discussing about a question where a person had asked that an 11-year-old doesn't like studying and they have to always force them to study and this leads to arguments, so how to avoid them? And then you said about how they're limited sometimes because of the school, and sometimes a child doesn't study because they are too smart, so they feel they don't need to study. And sometimes you said that they lack concentration, so we have to work on that. And you said you're going to tell us more about that, inshallah. Yeah.
And another fact is that probably, and most probably, it happens, we nag the child. And the child depends on us to study. It's like, waking up in the morning for the prayer. If you depend on your partner, whether it be your husband, your wife, your mother, your brother, whoever it is, then even if the azan is being recited, you'll say, but I'll sleep because I know I'll be waken up. Oh. I won't I won't go without being not waking up. Yeah. So you take it for granted. Whilst it's such a, it's not a good habit at all. You should be independent in that. In fact, test yourself in your independence, how much you can wake up yourself. In the same way, a child, if you enhance his motivation and how to, make him better study, and there are points that we are going to mention, inshallah, as we go along. So the child will himself feel like studying. You may motivate him in that way. Not that you, at the last moment, last hour, for example, of the last part of the day, homework time.
No,
it's not like that. Unfortunately, the nagging is always there, whilst parents don't know how to curb this problem. And it can be done so in a better way that it leaves the child independent for a very long time. And he feels like studying. He wants to study and he studies better that way, rather than being forced. When you force a child to eat, that food is not even digested properly. And the child, will feel hungry again. You'll be surprised. I've noticed that in my own child, that when she eats without, having the appetite to eat or being forced to eat like something that she doesn't like, after maybe 2 hours, she really feels hungry for the thing she wants.
Yeah.
So this is not a good thing, to force a child to study. They won't even learn properly. They won't even retain properly. They won't even, feel like they won't even get good grades in the end. So all these are factors that prevent a child from studying. We should know that.
And I think what you said previously about, the child being able to, concentrate and not being able to concentrate. I feel every child has different capabilities, different ways of being better. And sometimes because we don't know what is wrong with the child, we're not able to work on that. Yeah. So I feel like what you said was very important. Once you find out what's the reason that's preventing that child from growing and from, doing rushd, from reaching further in his goal, that's when you're able to make a difference.
That's right.
But when we don't find that out, then we're just stuck in one place,
So it shows that a mother needs to be so careful and have so much good knowledge about their child, right? Whom you're dealing with. Sometimes, parents do this mistake of quickly resorting to things like giving gifts, to their children. Momentarily telling them that if you, for example, bring the best marks, then I'll maybe take you to a trip or maybe give you this so-and-so gift, what you want, or a surprise, or something like that. So, this child will probably work just for the exam.
That's going to be their goal.
Yeah, that's going to be the goal. After he has achieved it, the study will be left aside.
Okay.
And we don't want that in our children. We want that to be a lifelong thing, right?
Yes.
We want to produce those kind of children who will work for the society, who will be beneficial for the society, who are study lovers, who are knowledge lovers. In every field, especially Islam, we want to train the smart children to recruit the power for Islam, to make them work, inshallah, for Islam.
They are the pioneers.
Yes, exactly.
We're just going to take a short break, inshallah, and we'll be back for more on this after the break. Stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. contact us at englishradio@irib.ir. Welcome back, dear audience, to IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran, and this is Islamic Upbringing.
So we resort to this. Now, this does not give a fruitful answer at all, because if you compare, for example, if a person at home, for example, a lady, she's so unorganized, she's so messy, and the husband wants her to be organized, so he brings her a gift and tells her, okay, this is your gift, but please promise me now, from now you'll be organized. So what will she do? She will be probably organized, but for how many days? Four or five days. Because this was not the motivating spirit for her. And then if you ask her, why don't you still continue the same way, she said that because nobody appreciates. So mostly if you tell a woman, for example, that how well you tidied the house, or for example, you tell her that I really appreciate that you changed the setting of the house, then she'll say somebody notices, or how you cook. Otherwise, she won't take interest. So in the same way, a person, a child who studies, if you compliment him in these kind of while studying, making study a beautiful process, a beautiful hobby, then the child will be interested. We will see how to go about doing this.
Then you have to make very innovative ideas to try and
make it interesting for him, that studying in itself is a good thing. Not that because you get something out of it.
Because usually then that's the goal, that if you do this, then you'll get this. And then we feel like, okay, because I want to get that gift, then I should study.
It's like, you know, the concept of sawab. We think sawab, when we get, when we do something, we will get sawab.
Yeah.
That doing thing is the sawab itself.
Very true.
It makes you grow. It makes you, better as a person in every way. For example, if you practice something good, in the process of practicing that only you grow.
Yeah.
You get the benefit.
And sometimes we then forget even the main goal.
We want Jannah. But the Jannah is here only whilst you are improving.
And reaching that, closeness to Allah.
Yes, that's right. So first of all, it's like the point to be taken into consideration to improve this studying ability of the child is to create a study atmosphere. Sometimes the house, is the television is on, the radio is on, the mother is talking on the telephone, the father is in his mobile reading newspapers, the children are scattered all over with their toys. Yeah. This is not a studying atmosphere. Studying atmosphere is quiet atmosphere. Studying atmosphere is an atmosphere where the table is, clean with books, and the mother is encouraging her, now it's study time. For example, she doesn't even have to say that, but just to create an atmosphere that the child knows that there are books on the table. His bag is there. He needs to now study. It's like 4 o'clock now. Maybe just to point out the time, that now it's time, that it's getting late. In indirect ways to create a study atmosphere. Maybe make something good for him to have, like tea and cookies or something, that the child is encouraged now that they need the energy, to study. So they have the energy now. So creating a studying atmosphere is very important.
I remember when I was a child, when I would get a new stationery specifically for studying, I would feel so much more motivated. I would see that, okay, my mom has given me this compass with, nice pencils, pens, and I'd feel like, okay, now I need to sit and study, that motivation.
That's right.
So we'll just stop for another short break, and inshallah, we will continue this very interesting conversation. يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
The Prophet صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم said, Honor your children and teach them good manners.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
So we are back on IRIB English Radio, and we were discussing about how to encourage children to study and how to, make them enjoy studying, inshallah.
Yeah. Reading skills is one important thing to create the study atmosphere. Always, like a parent, if they really want to improve the child in their study skills, even a parent needs to study. Like, for example, if a mother is talking away over the telephone or chatting away with someone, then there's no atmosphere of studying. But if the mother is sitting, for example, in the living room with a book, then the child will see how the mother is interested in reading
a book.
So much
more encouraged.
Yeah, so much more encouraged that there's something in reading. Mm. So reading skills always have to be encouraged in children. Either you read to the child or you encourage them that, you know, what kind of information should be more sought for, what is necessary, you know, something to do with the child's hobbies, what the child likes. For example, if he's interested in stars, you show him the latest telescope and see what stars have, you know, for example, yet not come, yet they have died down. Or something to do with maybe biology, if the child is so interested, maybe to tell him about an organ that Allah has created that, you know, is so beautiful that, or maybe our cells that, you know, go up to maybe 60 kilometers high, a tower, and 10 times more. Things like that that are very strange for a child, and he feels like getting to know more and more.
Those
questions,
exciting.
Yeah, exciting questions that are challenging. And there are children who love challenges more, you know. So just to give them this, you know, atmosphere of studying will make him like start it to study.
Very true, very true.
Unfortunately, sometimes we see that parents are comparing children. So-and-so, you know, he does this class and this class and this, and you have lagged behind or things like that. That's very, very, like, poisonous for a child. He hates to be compared. Every child is unique. Another point we should keep in mind is give the child to prioritize what he wants to do first in his day-to-day timetable. There should be a timetable for the child not to stay idle, you know. An idle mind is a devil's workshop. So the child will think and, you know, other things that are not useful, play games and everything. Give a timetable to the child such that, and tell him to prioritize. For example, when do you want to do your homework? During the day before the sun sets.
Mm.
So he will choose, and what extracurricular activity do you want to do apart from study? So maybe he'll say, I'll, for example, play this time to this time, or I'll attend my class from this time to this time. So I have only this time to do my homework. So when children, you know, they say it out of their own mouths, they are ready to, you know, stand by it more than when you tell them that, you know, like from 4 to 5, you have to study.
They feel like they made the decision.
They made the decision and that you should give the, you know, steering wheel to them,
true,
your child to decide. So that's very important.
But do you encouraged to have like a strict timetable, or should it be like
flexible?
Yeah, like should it be flexible? Because I think at times when a child is given a very strict timetable, they get pressured, and is that detrimental?
No, of course it is very detrimental. Flexible also we can mean that sometimes, you know, from this time to this time we do a certain act, and from other times we do another act. So that same time should be fixed. Sometimes it can, you know, like be flexible. For example, 3 days a week he goes to class, so you change that timing to another time. But know that those things need to be done.
Mm.
And also, you know, encourage him that it's like something to get over with so that he can do more his other things. For example, read more, you know, read his favorite books.
Unfortunately, that's all the time that we have. And we will continue this, inshallah, in the next episode. Dear audience, thank you very much for joining us on the program. If you have any questions, comments or suggestions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir, and visit us at our website, parstoday.ir. Inshallah, until the next program, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 31 meters, 9650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.